Warning. 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 Your brain is about to engage. Open your ears, close your mouth, and open your mind. Ladies and gentlemen, Visigoth's Grassy Knoll.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. All right, this is part one of an essay by Orwell entitled James Burnham and the Managerial Revolution. It appeared in New English Weekly in May of 1946. On my website, on the homepage, scroll down, you'll see the first Cold Warrior, I think it says. It's a three-piece article written on James Burnham. And, you know, he slipped by us without really knowing he was around, although I guess his last, you hear the bird going nuts here, the last prominence he had was probably during Reagan's administration when he was feted by Reagan. And I don't remember from that time. But the question about Burnham is whether or not this guy really was more of an asset to bring about global government. How much did he know? Was this predictive programming? Was he preparing? Or what was his purpose? He's supposed to be a good guy, but I don't really think he was, along with George Kennan, who believe in this containment policy as well, which I think has morphed into preemptive strikes, if you know what I'm saying. That's now the descendant of that. But Burnham is an interesting figure. Like I said, it's not the sexiest stuff, but if you want to know where the neocons came from, the present-day ones, check out this right after the Second World War. So, like I said, there's a three-part article on Burnham by Francis Sempa, and I think it bears taking a look. It fills a lot of gaps in, because that time after World War II, not too much seems to have happened, in a sense, on a global scale. A little hiatus between World War II and the Korean War, but a lot of stuff, I think, that is leading us into a socialized state was concocted back then. All right, so without further ado, we'll get into this. So James Burnham's book, The Managerial Revolution, made a considerable stir both in the United States and in this country, being England, at the time when it was published, and its main thesis has been so much discussed that a detailed exposition of it is hardly necessary. As shortly as I can summarize it, the thesis is, capitalism is disappearing, but socialism is not replacing it. What is now arising is a new kind of planned centralized society which will be neither capitalist nor, in any accepted sense of the word, democratic. The rulers of this new society will be the people who effectively control the means of production, that is, business executives, technicians, bureaucrats, and soldiers, lumped together by Burnham under the name of managers. These people will eliminate the old capitalist class, crush the working class, and so organize society that all power and economic privilege remain in their own hands. Private property rights will be abolished, but common ownership will not be established. The new managerial societies will not consist of a patchwork of small independent states, but of great superstates grouped around the main industrial centers in Europe, Asia, and America. So like corporate fascism to me. These superstates will fight amongst themselves for possession of the remaining uncaptured portions of the earth, but will probably be unable to conquer one another completely. Internally, each society will be hierarchical, with an aristocracy of talent at the top and a mass of semi-slaves at the bottom. I mean, I can't argue with that at all. And that isn't communism. I don't know what else is. Maybe communism light, whatever. But I think he hit it pretty much on the head, both Burnham and Orwell. In his next published book, The Machiavellians, Burnham elaborates and also modifies his original statement. A great part of the book is an exposition of the theories of Machiavelli and his modern disciples, Mosca, Michels, and Pareto. With doubtful justification, Burnham adds to these syndicalist, believe it or not, syndicalist writer, Georges Sorel. What Burnham is mainly concerned to show is that a democratic society has never existed, and so far as we can see, never will exist. Society is of its nature oligarchical, and the power of the oligarchy always rests upon force and fraud. Burnham does not deny that good motives may operate in private life, but he maintains that politics consists of the struggle for power and nothing else. All historical changes finally boil down to the replacement of one ruling class by another. All talk about democracy, liberty, equality, fraternity, all revolutionary movements, all visions of utopia, or the classless society, or the kingdom of heaven on earth, are humbug. In parentheses, not necessarily conscious, humbug. End of parentheses. Covering the ambitions of some new class which is elbowing its way into power. The English Puritans, the Jacobins, the Bolsheviks were in each case simply power seekers using the hopes of the masses in order to win a privileged position for themselves. Power can sometimes be won or maintained without violence, but never without fraud, because it is necessary to make use of the masses, and the masses would not cooperate if they knew they were simply serving the purposes of a minority. In each great revolutionary struggle, the masses are led on by vague dreams of human brotherhood. And then, when the new ruling class is well established in power, they are thrust back into servitude. This is practically the whole of political history as Burnham sees it. Where the second book departs from the earlier one is in asserting that the whole process could be somewhat moralized if the facts were faced more honestly. The Machiavellians is subtitled Defenders of Freedom. Machiavelli and his followers taught that in politics, decency simply does not exist. And by doing so, Burnham claims, made it possible to conduct political affairs more intelligently and less oppressively. A ruling class which recognized that its real aim was to stay in power would also recognize that it would be more likely to succeed if it served the common good and might avoid stiffening into a hereditary aristocracy. Burnham lays much stress on Pareto's theory of the circulation of the elites. If it is to stay in power, a ruling class must constantly admit suitable recruits from below, so that the ablest men may always be at the top, and a new class of power-hungry malcontents cannot come into being. This is likeliest to happen, Burnham considers, in a society which retains democratic habits, that is, where the opposition is permitted, and certain bodies such as the press and the trade unions can keep their autonomy. Here Burnham undoubtedly contradicts his earlier opinion. In the managerial revolution, which was written in 1940, it is taken as a matter of course that managerial Germany is in all ways more efficient than a capitalist democracy such as France or Britain. In the second book, written in 1942, Burnham admits that the Germans might have avoided some of their more serious strategic errors if they had permitted freedom of speech. However, the main thesis is not abandoned. Capitalism is doomed, and socialism is a dream. If we grasp at what is at issue, we might guide the course of the managerial revolution to some extent, but that revolution is happening whether we like it or not. In both books, but especially the earlier one, there is a note of unmistakable relish over the cruelty and wickedness of the processes that are being discussed. Although he reiterates that he is merely setting forth the facts and not stating his own preferences, it is clear that Burnham is fascinated by the spectacle of power and that his sympathies were with Germany so long as Germany appeared to be winning the war. A more recent essay, Lenin's Heir, published in the Partisan Review about the beginning of 1945, suggests that his sympathy has since been transferred to the USSR. Lenin's Heir, which provoked violent controversy in the American left-wing press, has not yet been reprinted in England, and I must return to it later. It will be seen that Burnham's theory is not, strictly speaking, a new one. Many earlier writers have foreseen the emergence of a new kind of society, neither capitalist nor socialist, and probably based upon slavery, though most of them have differed from Burnham in not assuming the development to be inevitable. A good example is Hilaire Belloc's book, The Servile State, published in 1911. The Servile State is written in a tiresome style, and the remedy it suggests, in parentheses, a return to small-scale peasant ownership, end of parentheses, is for many reasons impossible. Still, it does foretell, with remarkable insight, the kind of things that have been happening from about 1930 onwards. Chesterton, in a less methodical way, predicted the disappearance of democracy and private property and the rise of a slave society which might be called either capitalist or communist. Isn't that interesting? Jack London, in The Iron Heel, 1909, foretold some of the essential features of fascism and such books as Wells' The Sleeper Awakes, 1900. Zamyatin's We, 1923. And here we go, folks. Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, 1930. And London's The Iron Heel, which a listener has told me he has read, so it was very interesting. The published date for that is 1909. I might go hunting around for that sucker. Anyway, all self-described imaginary worlds in which the special problems of capitalism have been solved without bringing liberty, equality, or true happiness any nearer. More recently, writers like Peter Drucker, F.A. Voigt, have argued that fascism and communism are substantially the same thing. And indeed, it has always been obvious that a planned and centralized society is liable to develop into an oligarchy or a dictatorship. Orthodox conservatives were unable to see this because it comforted them to assume that socialism wouldn't work and that the disappearance of capitalism would mean chaos and anarchy. Orthodox socialists could not see it because they wished to think that they themselves would soon be in power and therefore assumed that when capitalism disappears, socialism takes its place. As a result, they were unable to foresee the rise of fascism or to make correct predictions about it after it had appeared. Later, the need to justify the Russian dictatorship and to explain away the obvious resemblances between communism and Nazism clouded the issue still more, with the notion that industrialism must end a monopoly and that monopoly must imply tyranny is not a startling one. Where Burnham differs from most other thinkers is in trying to plot the course of the managerial revolution accurately on a world scale, and assuming that the drift towards totalitarianism is irresistible and must not be fought against, though it may be guided. According to Burnham, writing in 1940, managerialism has reached its fullest development in the USSR, but is almost equally developed in Germany and has made its appearance in the United States. He describes the New Deal as primitive managerialism. And if we, like we've always said, I mean, Roosevelt, FDR, Frankie the Red, was placed in charge of doing what he had to do to more Sovietize, socialize, and federalize the United States government. Back to Orwell, but the trend is the same everywhere, or almost everywhere. Always laissez-faire capitalism gives way to planning and state interference. The mere owner loses power as against the technician and the bureaucrat. But socialism, that is to say what used to be called socialism, shows no sign of emerging. Some apologists try to excuse Marxism by saying that it has never had a chance. This is far from the truth. Marxism and the Marxist parties have had dozens of chances. In Russia, a Marxist party took up power. Within a short time, it abandoned socialism, if not in words, at any rate in the effect of its actions. In most European nations, there were, during the last months of the First World War and the years immediately thereafter, social crises which left a wide open door for the Marxist parties. Without exception, they proved unable to take and hold power. In a large number of countries, Germany, Denmark, Norway, Sweden, Austria, England, Australia, New Zealand, Spain, France, the reformist Marxist parties have administered the governments and have uniformly failed to introduce socialism or make any genuine steps towards socialism. These parties have, in practice, at every historical test, and there have been many, either failed socialism or abandoned it. This is the fact which neither the bitterest foe nor the most ardent friend of socialism can erase. This fact does not, as some think, prove anything about the moral quality of the socialist ideal, but it does constitute unblinkable evidence that whatever is moral quality, socialism is not going to come. Sorry about that. There was a typo in this article. Let me read that again. But it does not constitute unblinkable evidence that whatever its moral quality, socialism is not going to come. Burnham does not, of course, deny that the new managerial regimes, like the regimes of Russia and Nazi Germany, may be called socialist. He means merely that they will not be socialist in any sense of the word, which would have been accepted by Marx or Lenin or Keir Hardie or William Morris or indeed by any representative socialist prior to about 1930. Socialism until recently was supposed to connote political democracy, social equality, and internationalism. There is not the smallest sign that any of these things is in a way to being established anywhere. And the one great country in which something described as a proletariat revolution once happened, that is the USSR, has moved steadily away from the old concept of a free and equal society aiming at universal human brotherhood. In an almost unbroken progress since the early days of the revolution, liberty has been chipped away and representative institutions smothered, while inequalities have increased and nationalism and militarism have grown stronger. But at the same time, Burnham insists, there has been no tendency to return to capitalism. What is happening is simply the growth of managerialism, which, according to Burnham, is in progress everywhere, though the manner in which it comes about may vary from country to country. Now, as an interpretation of what is happening, Burnham's theory is extremely plausible, to put it at the lowest. The events of, at any rate, the last 15 years in the USSR can be be far more easily explained by this theory than by any other. Evidently, the USSR is not socialist and can only be called socialist if one gives the word a meaning different from what it would have in any other context. On the other hand, prophecies that the Russian regime would revert to capitalism have always been falsified and now seem further than ever from being fulfilled. In claiming the process had gone almost equally far in Nazi Germany, Burnham probably exaggerates, but it seems certain that the drift was away from the old-style capitalism and towards a planned economy with an adaptive oligarchy in control. In Russia, the capitalists were destroyed first, and the workers were crushed later. In Germany, the workers were crushed first, but the elimination of the capitalists had at any rate begun. And calculations based on the assumption that Nazism was simply capitalism were always contradicted by events. Where Burnham seems to go most astray is in believing managerialism to be on the upgrade in the United States, the one great country where free capitalism is still vigorous. Now, I don't think Burnham was wrong. But if one considers the world movement as a whole, his conclusions are difficult to resist. And even in the United States, the all-prevailing faith in laissez-faire may not survive the next great economic crisis. It has been urged against Burnham that he assigns far too much importance to the managers, in the narrow sense of the word, that is, factory bosses, planners, and technicians, and seems to assume that even in Soviet Russia, it is these people, and not the Communist Party chiefs, who are the real holders of power. However, this is a secondary error, and it is particularly corrected in the Machiavellians. The real question is not whether the people who wipe their boots on you during the next 50 years are to be called managers, bureaucrats, or politicians. The question is whether capitalism, now obviously doomed, is to give way to oligarchy or to true democracy. But curiously enough, when one examines the predictions which Burnham has based on his general theory, one finds that in so far as they are verifiable, they have been falsified. Numbers of people have pointed this out already. However, it is worth following up Burnham's predictions in detail because they form a sort of pattern which is related to contemporary events and which reveals, I believe, a very important weakness in present-day political thought. To begin with, writing in 1940, Burnham takes a German victory more or less for granted. Britain is described as dissolving and is displaying all the characteristics which have been distinguished decadent cultures in past historical transitions. Those are Burnham's words. While the conquest and integration of Europe, which Germany achieved in 1940, is described as, in quotes, irreversible. England, writes Burnham, no matter with what non-European allies, cannot conceivably hope to conquer the European continent. If Germany should somehow manage to lose the war, she should not be dismembered or reduced to the status of the Weimar Republic, but is bound to remain as the nucleus of a unified Europe. The future map of the world, with its three great superstates, is in any case already settled in its main outlines. And the nuclei of those three superstates are whatever may be their future names, the previously existing nations, Japan, Germany, and the United States. Burnham also commits himself to the opinion that Germany will not attack the USSR until after Britain has been defeated. In a condensation of his book, published in the Partisan Review, May-June 1941, and presumably written later than the book itself, he says, quote, as in the case of Russia, so with Germany, the third part of the managerial problem, the contest for dominance with other sections of managerial society, remains for the future. First had to come the death blow that assured the toppling of the capitalist world order, which meant above all the destruction of the foundations of the British Empire, in parentheses, the keystone of the capitalist world order. Both directly and through the smashing of the European political structure, which was a necessary prop of the empire. This is the basic explanation of the Nazi-Soviet pact, which is not intelligible on other grounds. The future conflict between Germany and Russia will be a managerial conflict proper. Prior to the great world managerial battles, the end of the capitalist order must be assured. The belief that Nazism is decadent capitalism makes it impossible to explain reasonably the Nazi-Soviet pact. From this belief followed the always expected war between Germany and Russia, not the actual war to the death between Germany and the British Empire. The war between Germany and Russia is one of the managerial wars of the future, not of the anti-capitalist wars of yesterday and today. However, the attack on Russia will come later, and Russia is certain, or almost certain, to be defeated. There is every reason to believe that Russia will split apart, with the western half gravitating toward the European base, and the eastern toward the Asiatic. This quote, this quotation comes from the Managerial Revolution. And the above-quoted article, which probably about 6 months later, put it more forcibly. The Russian weaknesses indicate that Russia will not be able to endure, that it will crack apart and fall towards east and west, end of quote. And in a supplementary note, which was added to the English Pelican edition of the book, and which appears to have been written at the end of 1941, Burnham speaks as though the cracking apart process were already happening. The war, he says, is part of the means whereby the western half of Russia is being integrated into the European superstate. You know, that's interesting, too, because wasn't it just the other way around? It was the Soviet Union that bled into Eastern Europe. And here he claims that Eastern Europe nations, are sucking the Russians toward them. You know, I guess it's a bit of a viewpoint here. Sorting these various statements out, we have the following prophecies. Germany is bound to win the war. Germany and Japan are bound to survive as great states and remain the nuclei of power in their respective area. Germany will not attack the USSR until after the defeat of Britain. The USSR is bound to be defeated. However, Burnham has made other predictions besides these. In a short article in the Partisan Review in the summer of 1944, he gives his opinion that the USSR will gang up with Japan in order to prevent the total defeat of the latter, while the American communists will be set to work to sabotage the eastern end of the war. And finally, in an article in the same magazine in the winter of 1944-1945, he claims that Russia, destined so short a while ago to crack apart, is within sight of conquering the whole of Eurasia. This article, which was the cause of violent controversies among the American intelligentsia, has not been reprinted in England. I must give some account of it here because its manner of approach and its emotional tone are of a peculiar kind, and by studying them one can get nearer to the real roots of Burnham's theory. The article is entitled Lenin's Heir, and it sets out to show that Stalin is the true and legitimate guardian of the Russian Revolution, which he has not in any case betrayed, but has merely carried forward on lines that were implicit in it from the start. In itself, this is an easier opinion to swallow than the usual Trotskyite claim that Stalin is a mere crook who has perverted the revolution to his own ends, and that things would somehow have been different if Lenin had lived or Trotsky had remained in power. Actually, there is no strong reason for thinking that the main lines of development would have been very different. Well before 1923, the seeds of a totalitarian society were quite plainly there. Lenin, indeed, is one of those politicians who win an undeserved reputation by dying prematurely. And we have a note here. Note 1. Had he lived, this would be Lenin, it is probable that he would either have been thrown out, like Trotsky, or would have kept himself in power by methods as barbarous or nearly as barbarous as those of Stalin. The title of Burnham's essay, therefore, sets forth a reasonable thesis, and one would expect him to support it by an appeal to the facts. Moving on. However, the essay barely touches upon its ostensible subject matter. It is obvious that anyone genuinely concerned to show that there has been continuity of policy is between Lenin and Stalin would start by outlining Lenin's policy and then explain in what way Stalin has resembled it. Burnham does not do this. Except for one or two cursory sentences, he says nothing about Lenin's policy, and Lenin's name only occurs 5 times in an essay of 12 pages. In the first 7 pages, apart from the title, it does not occur at all. The real aim of the essay is to present Stalin as a towering superhuman figure, indeed a species of demigod, and Bolshevism as an irresistible force which is flowing over the earth and cannot be halted until it reaches the outermost borders of Eurasia. Insofar as he makes any attempt to prove his case, Burnham does so by repeating over and over again that Stalin is a great man, which is probably true, but is also completely irrelevant. Moreover, though, he does advance some solid arguments for believing in Stalin's genius. It is clear that in his mind, the idea of greatness is inextricably mixed up with the idea of cruelty and dishonesty. There are curious passages in which it seems to be suggested that Stalin is to be admired because of the limitless suffering that he has caused. Stalin proves himself a great man in the grand style. This is a quote. The accounts of the banquet staged in Moscow for the visiting dignitaries set the symbolic tone. With their enormous menus of sturgeon and roasts and fowl and sweets, their streams of liquor, the scores of toasts with which they end, the silent, unmoving secret police behind each guest, all against the winter background of the starving multitudes of besieged Leningrad, the dying millions at the front, the jammed concentration camps, the city crowds kept by their minute rations just at the edge of life. There is little trace of dull mediocrity or the hand of Babbitt. We recognize, rather, that the tradition of the most spectacular of the Tsars, of the great kings of the Medes and Persians, of the Khanati, of the Golden Horde, of the banquet we assign to the gods of the heroic ages in tribute to the insight that insolence and indifference and brutality on such a scale remove beings from the human level. Stalin's political technique shows a freedom from conventional restrictions that is incompatible with mediocrity. The mediocre man is custom-bound. Often it is the scale of their operation that sets them apart. It is usual, for example, for men active in practical life to engineer an occasional frame-up, but to carry out a frame-up against tens of thousands of persons, important percentages of whole strata of society, including most of one's own comrades, is so far out of the ordinary that the long-run mass conclusion is either the frame-up must be true, at least have some truth in it, or that power so immense must be submitted to, is a historical necessity, as intellectuals put it. There is nothing unexpected in letting a few individuals starve for reasons of state, but to starve by deliberate decision several millions is a type of action attributed ordinarily only to gods. In these and other similar passages, there may be a tinge of irony, but it is difficult not to feel that there is also a sort of fascinated admiration. Toward the end of the essay, Burnham compares Stalin with those semi-mythical heroes like Moses or Osaka, who embody in themselves a whole epoch and can justly be credited with feats that they did not actually perform. In writing of Soviet foreign policy and its supposed objectives, he touches an even more mystical note. Starting from the magnetic core of the Eurasian heartland, the Soviet power, like the reality of the one of Neo-Platoism, overflowing in the descending series of the eminent progression, flows outward, west into Europe, south into the Near East, east into China, already lapping the shores of the Atlantic, the Yellow and China Seas, the Mediterranean, the Persian Gulf. As the undifferentiated one, in its progressions, descends through the stages of mind, soul, and matter, and then through its final return back to itself, so does the Soviet power emanating from the integrally totalitarian center proceed outwards by absorption, in parentheses, the Baltics, Bessarabia, Bukovina, East Poland, by domination, Finland, the Balkans, Mongolia, North China, and tomorrow Germany, the orienting influence, Italy, France, Turkey, Iran, Central and South China, until it is dissipated in the MHON, the outer material sphere, beyond the Eurasian boundaries of momentary appeasement and infiltration, England and the United States. I know it's a tough paragraph to listen to one read, but it's also, you know, this text is not written to be read. I do not think it is fanciful to suggest that the unnecessary capital letters with which this passage is loaded are intended to have a hypnotic effect on the reader. Burnham is trying to build up a picture of terrifying, irresistible power, and to turn a normal political maneuver like infiltration into infiltration, with a capital I, adds to the general portentousness. The essay should be read in full, although it is not the kind of tribute that the average Russophile would consider acceptable, and although Burnham himself would probably claim that he is being strictly objective, he is in effect performing an act of homage, and even of self-abasement. Meanwhile, this essay gives us another prophecy to add to the list, that is that the USSR will conquer the whole of Eurasia, and probably a great deal more. And one must remember that Burnham's basic theory contains, in itself, a prediction which still has to be tested, that is, that whatever else happens, the managerial form of society is bound to prevail. And we'll end it right there. That's the end of part one of James Burnham and the Managerial Revolution, which appeared in May 1946 in New English Weekly. And we'll continue with this next week.